Thanks. My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November the 11th, 1988, and I'm real grateful for that. But I've had a great time down here. I always do when I come down here, and you know, I get filled up, and I'm able to go back up there. They call me Montana Mike from Idaho. My last drink was in Montana. I lived in Montana for quite a few years, and now I live in Idaho, and the Montana part kind of always stuck, so now it's Montana Mike from Idaho. But, you know, I loved Montana when I lived up there. We were back there at the table talking about it a little bit. One of the gals back there, she'd been in the little town I lived in Montana, Red Lodge. We were talking about that, and she said that she'd gone over and seen Cheap Joseph, where they were doing the Cheap Joseph over in South Dakota, and she was in a little town, Corvette. They were having a Corvette show in Spearhead, South Dakota, and I was kind of reminiscing on being back there a few years ago. A couple of us were over there to Sturgis, and we drove her over there to a little meeting, and John, Motorhome John, was with us, and if you guys remember Motor, he's one you don't forget, and Keith rode over to the meeting with him, and we got over there, and Keith said, my hell, by the time we were halfway here, he had me wanting to drink, and you know, John still has, you know, some difficulties. He doesn't make wise decisions. John doesn't, and I had a call two days ago. Tate called me and says that John was getting his power shut off. So he went down to the pawn shop to pawn a bunch of stuff off to get some money to pay his power bill, and he come home with all these toilet seats, just a whole huge amount of toilet seats. So he pawned all this stuff off to get money, and instead of getting money, he bought these toilet seats and said it was such a good deal he couldn't pass it up. And Tate says, what do I tell him? And I says, well, tell him he can put some of them around his neck when they turn the power off and run around the dark. I have fun with them guys there, the guys up in Idaho and Utah there. They said to say hi to you guys. They're all packing Tate up. He bought a house in Idaho not too far from me, and they're moving him Monday and Tuesday, so he'll kind of be up in that area. But you know, they miss you guys and enjoy being around you too, and you know, this is where I do the best in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's where I do the best and I feel comfortable. I don't want to crawl out of my own skin when I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, it wasn't always like that. I from an early age I had problems. You know, I grew up on a cattle ranch, and so I was away from other people kind of growing up, and I found booze when I was young. I was real young. My sister got a bottle of vodka, and you know, my folks didn't drink around us, so I had never really, I mean, I'd seen them lit up, but they didn't drink around us where I'd watched them, and she got this bottle of vodka, and we, neither one of us had a clue how to drink, and so we got us two big glasses, and we poured the vodka in one and water in the other, and we'd plug our nose and guzzle the vodka and then guzzle the water and look at each other and did anything happen to you? And she said no, and I said the same thing. So we tried it again, and I don't know how many times we did that, but when it hit, it was immediate. And I can just remember being immediately drunk, and then I don't remember anything else. And the next morning, my sister was showing me what I'd done to all the lawn chair in the backyard. I destroyed all the lawn chair. I don't know if it was the color of it or what it was, but I destroyed it. And that's kind of how my drinking was from then on. My drinking was always kind of like that. I would get drunk and do things and wonder why I'd done them. And I did. I started drinking at a young age, and I started doing some other things at a young age. The first time I ever smoked pot, some guy come out and he had some pot, and we smoked pot, and he had it in his back pocket. And I remember going down to the river. We were going fishing. We were both laughing, and I reached up and took it out of his back pocket and put it down my pants. Immediately from smoking my first time I ever smoked pot, I become a thief. And then we spent all afternoon going up and down the river looking for that. And we looked for so long, I almost gave it back. And that's how it was. That's how my drinking and drugging was. There was never any control, and there was always a dilemma in it. And, you know, I started ending up in trouble at a young age. And it was just petty trouble in the beginning. And the first thing was just a simple thing, but it was, they took it kind of serious. We were over to the football stands, and a bunch of us were drinking, and we rolled this big wheelie wagon that they cooked the hot dogs in down the bleachers. And it just rolled down the bleachers, but it did thousands and thousands of dollars worth of damage as it rolled down the bleachers. And we got caught for it, and that was the start of dumb problems from drinking, just dumb stuff that I used to do. They started sending me to counselors at an early age, and shortly after that, they started sending me to treatment centers. It takes what it takes, and I finally got sober in my 13th inpatient treatment program after I was in my 26th detox. In the beginning, I'd be in there, and I had no desire to stop drinking or stop doing what I was doing. I just ended up in trouble one more time, and I wanted out of the trouble, and I kind of went through their thing, and I'd get out, and I'd head back to where I'd been. But the last few years I was drinking, I gave those treatment centers a shot. I wanted to make a change, and I'd go in them, and I'd get out and end up what I call struck drunk, and that's what I used to always do. I had full intentions not to drink, and I was in one in Blackfoot, Idaho, which is about 2 hours north of where I live, and the day we got out, I rode home with some guys from Montpelier, and we got drunk on the way home, and it got to where my sobriety or my attempts at staying sober were shorter and shorter from those treatment centers, there at the end, there was nothing left. There was no hope when I'd hit them treatment centers. There was just nothing left. I drank myself out of a place to live. I drank myself out of friends. I drank myself out of work. My last drink was in Missoula, Montana. I was being thrown out of a bar. I don't know why I was being thrown out of the bar up there, but I was being thrown out of the bar. I was drinking shots of tequila with some guys, and just before they threw me out, the two guys had their tequila sitting there, and I drank both their shots, and then they really threw me out. And that was the last drink I ever remember having. I got in my car, and I headed down the road, and I think they must have called the police from that bar, because I got pulled over, and I was extremely drunk. And when I was getting pulled over, it was like a godsend. It was like it's over, it's over. I don't have to continue on. And this cop come up to the window, and he looked at me, and he said he could tell I was drunk, and he had to respond to an injury accident. And he told me, he said, if I didn't have to respond to this injury accident, you would go to jail right now. And he said, do not drive. And he run back to his car and got in his car and took off. And I thought I was being saved when he was pulling me over, and I got in the car and chased him. I was so drunk, he outrun me. I couldn't keep up with him. He did. He outrun me. I woke up laying next to my car the next morning. That was November the 11th, 1988, and it snowed on me all night. I don't know why I was laying next to the car, but I know I woke up, and I was covered in snow, and I got back in this car, drove down the street, and there was a detox there. It was in Galen. I'd been to that detox before, and I went and I checked in that detox again. And like I said there at the end, it was just a hopeless state when I checked in them in those things, because I couldn't stay sober. And what happened in that one, I believe it was my spiritual experience, but I was given hope. I just was filled with hope. Somehow, after all the times I've been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and all the times I tried to get sober, I was in that last detox and I just knew I could get sober if I did Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I could get sober, and I believe it was a God-given gift of hope, is what I believe. And I just had that inner feeling I could get sober. And from there I went to that last treatment center and I did. I managed to get sober. I got out of there, went to Butte, spent 30 days in Butte, and just because we get sober doesn't mean we quit moving. And that's what I've done my whole life, is I just, or ever since I was a kid. I was a runaway as a kid. I run away. It was picked up on an APB, brought back, but I could never stay put. You know, I was a runaway kid, and for the last many years, I just been bounced around from town to town, state to state, and living the life of a drunk. And I got sober, and just because we get sober don't mean we quit doing all that. And I moved down here. I had a sister in Southern California, moved down here in 1980. So from 1980 on, I used to kind of end up in Southern California until she told me I couldn't stay on her couch anymore, and then I'd move on. But I ended up down here, and I went to some of the meetings I used to go to in Southern California before, and one of those meetings had a guy in there that, the same guy, and I didn't like this guy. I didn't like what this guy said or the way he acted towards me. His name was Alan, and I got a job down here, and when I got sober, I had this station wagon, and everything I owned was in this station wagon. I had a box of clothes, and I had one pair of shoes. They were my work shoes, my AA shoes, my play shoes. When I got sober, I had one pair of shoes, and they had holes in them, so if it was raining outside, my socks got wet. So I got a job, and I went into, I got my first paycheck, and I went into the boot barn, and I bought a pair of boots, and I bought a pair of suede boots. They were the cheapest boots in my size they had, but it's all I could afford, I went to the meeting with my new boots on, and Alan looked at them, and he looked at me, and he said, "Nice boots, Mike." And this was on a Wednesday night, and through that Wednesday meeting, I got madder and madder at him for saying that, because I thought he insulted me about these boots, and I believe Alan was trying to be kind at that time, but I took it as an insult. I did. I took it as an insult, and I thought about that all day Thursday, and I know where he went Friday to the meeting. And I went to that meeting Friday, and I was so raged with his comment that I was going to follow him out and confront him on it. And I thought, well, I'll follow him out, and I'll hit him in the nose when he goes out to have a cigarette. And he went out to have a cigarette, and I followed him out. And the next thing I knew, I was asked if he'd sponsor me. And this is honestly what Alan said to me when I asked him to sponsor me. He said, "You know, Mike, you think it's a privilege for me to sponsor you, but what you're really saying is, Alan, I'm a piece of shit. Can you help me?" This was it. So I left there, and he says that if I was serious, to call him tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. And I left there, and I went and sat down, and I kept thinking about what he just said how I should have hit him. But the next day, you know, I could have told you at any given time of the day what time it was. I called Alan at exactly 6 p.m. It wasn't 1 minute to, it wasn't 1 minute after. It was at 6 p.m. I called him, and Alan said, "Are you going to the meeting tonight?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I'll see you there," and hung up. That started it. And, you know, Alan told me that's where he started with me, to see how willing I was to see if I'd call at 6 p.m. I was willing. You know, I was willing. I was willing. I'd hit a point that I was willing. And Alan used to have me do things. You know, I was depressing. I was depressing when I was new. I remember going to a meeting one time and Alan telling me to go sit at that other table. He said, "Go sit over there, Mike. You are depressing." I had all these problems, and I wanted to talk to Alan about them. When I try to talk to him about it, he'd say ignorant things to me. But when I start talking about the solution and what I can do to get better, that's when Alan started talking to me. From the get-go, he had me going down to Charlie Street and picking up new guys. He'd have me go down to Charlie Street and get these new guys. This great big red-headed kid showed up down there. His name was Jerry. And Alan had me go pick Jerry up, and I went down, I picked Jerry up, and, And Jerry was one of them guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a great big red-headed kid from northern Idaho. And he's one of them kids that you just didn't want to hang around with in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was depressing. Jerry was depressing. And we went to the meeting, and Alan told Jerry to ask me to sponsor him. And I don't want to sponsor Jerry. And Alan says, Mike, you need to, or you'll never stay here. So I said, what do I do? And Alan told me to do exactly with Jerry what he was doing with me. And he said, you know, Jerry's in the house, and he can lead with the sponsor on Sundays. I needed to go pick him up. So I went and picked Jerry up on Sunday and took Jerry to a bull buckout in Narco, California. And I convinced Jerry to get on a bull. I paid his $14 entry fee. And just before Jerry got on the bull, he came up and he said, Mike, I can't get on that bull. I can't afford to get hurt. And I explained to Jerry how he was in there because he had 5 DUIs. He didn't have a job. He was going to go to jail and had nowhere to live. And there was really no reason he couldn't be hurt. Jerry agreed with me and rolled that bull, and he lived. The next Sunday, since I hadn't got him killed there, I went and picked him up, and Jerry said, we're not going to another rodeo, are we? And I said, no, we're going out in the Riverside Desert, and we're going to look for rattlesnakes. I figured maybe I could get him bit. We went out there, and me and Jerry were driving around out there in the Riverside Desert. We were out in the middle of nowhere, and we went up this hill, and all of a sudden there's cars all over, and Jerry said, it's another rodeo, isn't it? I started looking around about the same time I noticed that Jerry noticed it was a nude photography shoot. And we just kind of ended up there, and there was nude women everywhere. Me and Jerry parked my car and started the tour. About halfway through the tour, I told Jerry, I said, you know, Alan told me if I did this 12-step work that there'd be blessings in it. A couple weeks later, Jerry came to the meeting, and he had all his photography equipment. He was talking people into going out in the Riverside Desert, and they couldn't find this place. I don't know how many times Jerry talked different people into going out there looking for this place, but they never found it again. So you have to be working with others to find the place. I started working the steps with Jerry, I'd do the exact same thing with Jerry Allen would do with me. I'd have Jerry read the same book and do the same thing. I'd go over to Alan's house and be talking to Alan, and Alan would tell me, you know what your problem is, Mike? You need to grow up. You need to grow up. So I'd be with Jerry that night, and I'd tell Jerry, I said, Jerry, you know what your problem is? You need to grow up. You just need to grow up. Me and Jerry would have a new guy in my, we called it the AA limo, and it was my station wagon I got sober with, and it was rough looking. That station wagon was rough looking. I'd lived in it the last couple of years I was drunk, it had dents from the front to the back. I was in there one time, and I had a Freeman hatchet, and I chopped the heater, the radio, the air conditioner, everything, a big hole in the dashboard. And people used to get in there and ask me what happened, and I'd tell them, they'd say, why? And I'd tell them the truth, I don't know. I just chopped my dashboard all apart one day. So I didn't have a heater. I'd be cold a lot of nights, and one night I built a big fire next to the car, and I pulled the car next to the fire to keep it warm, and I burnt the one side of my car. So the one side of the car was burnt. It had dents from the front to the back. It had a big hole in it. One night I was sleeping in it, and I felt these fingers going through my hair as I was sleeping. I thought that I'd got lucky the night before and been in the bar and found somebody really nice. And I took my sleeping bag down, and the car was full of chickens. And I don't mean just a few. I mean it was full of chickens. Evidently, I'd gone to get a chicken, and I was a greedy drunk, so I'd taken an awfully lot of chickens. When you're down and out like I was, you don't want to let a good thing go, so I kept most of them. They lived in the car with me, and it was kind of like Easter every morning. But those chickens did some damage to the seats. They tore the seats all up, and so the seats had all the padding coming out. So me and Jerry would be in this car, and we'd go to Charlie Street to pick these new guys up. Alan would send me and Jerry to get these new guys, and we'd pick them up, and we'd have one of these new guys in the back, and me and Jerry would be up front arguing about who was more immature, me or him. And we'd have this new guy looking at the seats and the side of the window where he couldn't see out because it was bubbled from being burnt, and the hole in the dashboard, and me and Jerry up there arguing, and about halfway there we'd turn around and look at him, and we'd say, "So you want to get sober?" And I'd say, "Well, if you want what we have, you got to do what we do." And we'd get to the meeting, and this guy'd go tell Alan that these two aren't right in the head. Is there any way I can get a ride home with somebody else? I talk about Jerry, and Jerry finally fired me as a sponsor because he passed me in the steps. And in AA Comes of Age, where it talks about Jack Alexander doing his article in the Saturday Evening Post and all these frantic alcoholics coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it literally become the blind leading the blind, and that's what me and Jerry were, the blind leading the blind. And Alan had enough sense to know that if I was trying to help Jerry, that somehow I wouldn't drink, and I was trying to help Jerry, and somehow Jerry didn't drink, and as far as I know, Jerry's still sober. He lives up in Seattle, and he's doing quite well, and was the blind leading the blind. He fired me. He ended up in one of those kind of barrack institutions where they can go to work. It's an option rather than jail, and so we had a lot of, he couldn't leave on the nights. He'd go to work, and he was locked up in there on the weekends and every night, and so he was able to work on his steps more, and he ended up passing me. But one of the last visits I had with Jerry in that house, Jerry had called me, and there was a message on the phone when we got home, and he could tell it was from Jerry, and it said, "Mike, I need to talk to you," and he could hear some trouble in Jerry's voice, I ended up talking to Jerry later that day, and I said, "What's up, Jerry?" And he said, I have a rat that I've been taking care of in here. It was living under the sink, and they come in with decon, and they killed this rat, and Jerry was tore up over them killing this rat, this wild rat. And so the last time I went in there to see Jerry, I went to a pet store, and I got a rat, a $2.50 rat. And just before I went in through the, you got to go meet the people and sign in and check in and all that before they turn you into their rooms. And I put this rat down my boot, and as I was checking in everything, it left my boot and started going up my pant leg. I got in Jerry's room, and as soon as I got around the corner, I started tearing my pants off. And I remember Jerry's eyes just huge, like, "What are we going to do this visiting Sunday?" Jerry kept that rat alive the whole time he was in there. But Alan taught me from an early state in Alcoholics Anonymous to work with the new guy. And I did. I tried to work with the new guy. I remember one time I was talking to some guy, and he didn't want nothing to do with me. And Alan come up behind me, and he says, "You know what, Mike? You're probably driving more people away than you're keeping here, but you're still here." And that's, I would. I just try to carry that message. I try to carry that message. A guy come along, and I was kind of going through a dilemma, and I asked Alan, I said, "What do you suggest I do?" And Alan said, "See that guy right there? Go tell him that, because he wants to get sober, go tell him you'll pick him up every day for 30 days and take him to a meeting." And this guy was about as different as anybody I'd ever been around. His name was Paul, and he sold vitamins for a living. He drove a Honda Civic, and he lived in a house in Irvine. He was just different. Me and Paul weren't alike, but we went to a meeting, and Paul was talking about his inner feelings at that meeting, and I had a connection with Paul, and it was a connection to Alcoholics Anonymous for me. I realized how much like Paul I really was, how much like the other alcoholic I was, Paul told the story about he drank so many beers in the bottle, he didn't want the neighbors to know when the garbage man come to hear him cheating. So we'd put them in garbage bags in his garage and break them so that they'd go in the garbage can and they wouldn't ching around as they were going in the garbage truck. And I can understand that humility from drinking too much and the humility he was feeling. And, you know, he had a goldfish, and I remember looking at his goldfish one day, and I was looking in there, and the more I looked at that goldfish, I started feeling sorry for it. I said, "How long has this thing been in here?" And he said, "About 3 years." And I said, "You mean it's been in there alone for 3 years?" And I said, "Paul, that isn't right." I said, "You need to get another goldfish and put in there." And Paul did, and he came to the meeting. He said, "Well, thanks a lot, Mike." And I said, "What?" And he said, "I got another goldfish like you told me to," and the next morning they were both dead. So, so my suggestions to the new guy weren't always correct, but like Alan says, you know, I was still here. I was still able to stay at Alcoholics Anonymous trying to help that new guy. And I got down here and I wanted to leave. I wanted to one more time move. And you know, Alan, I remember, and this was a powerful talk. It still stays with me. But Alan was talking about, if I were to leave now, my chances of staying sober were real slim. He said, "I haven't made it through the process of the steps." And Alan told me that, Mike, he said, "You go through the process of these steps, and I can arm you that you can go anywhere. You can go anywhere." And I believe that. I believe that. Alan convinced me to stay, and I stayed here till I finished those steps. After I finished those steps, I did. I went up. I made a planned move, and I'd moved all over the damn country when I was drinking. I had, and it really was never a move. I was always leaving somewhere because I was, and a lot of times it was fast. I had to get out of there fast, I was always leaving somewhere. This was a planned move. I went up there. I found a job prior to going. I went up there. I met some people. I went to some meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a planned move. I moved up there, and I stayed in contact with Alan on a regular basis for a long time up there. And I'd come down and see Alan, and Alan become part of my life. Even though I was up there, and you know, I had like we were talking about Montana earlier. I had some fantastic years in Montana, and working with the new guys and doing Alcoholics Anonymous, where I was content. I was just content, and through circumstances and a divorce and a remarriage, I ended up over in Idaho. But I still hold dearly to Montana. I was going to a meeting one time in Montana. I lived just outside of Montana. I lived in Red Lodge, and then I lived in a little town called Laurel. And I was going into from Laurel to Billings one night to a meeting. And I was going down the Frontage Road. It was in the early winter. It was cold. And as I was going, I was on the Frontage Road. There was all these little fires along the road, and I thought somebody was going down the road with sparks going from their vehicle or something, starting all these fires. And I finally come up, and there's a guy standing by one. And I was on the Frontage Road, and I yelled over if he was okay. And this guy come running down through the, I call them bar pits. They call them borrow pits. I call them bar pits the side of the road, because after the bar, we used to end up in them a lot. So that's what I always called them. But he come running down through the borrow pit there and through the fence and run over. And I could tell this guy was drunk, and he jumped in my truck, and he said, "My damn bitch sister left me," and this guy was just drunk, and he said, "I went in the store and she took off," and he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going into Billings," and he said, "I'll go with you," and I said, "Well, no, I said, "Where do you want to go?" And he said, "Let's go to a lounge," and I said, "You know, I don't want to go to a lounge," and he started pulling all these beers out of his pocket, and he said, "Here, have a beer." And I said, "No, I don't drink." And I said, "Well, where do you live? I'll take you home." And he told me where he lived. And he said, "But I don't want to go home. I want to go wherever you're going." And I told this guy, and I said, "Well, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." And from the time this guy had got in until then, he hadn't shut up. And he had just shut him up. This guy just shut up. And all of a sudden he said, take me with you. And I said, have you ever been? He said, oh, I've been a bunch of times, but they don't work, but I need to go back. And I took him with me, and it's the only meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever been thrown out of. They told me to leave. They told me, and this guy, he wanted a fist fight with the chairperson. He was trying to get this gal to sit on his lap. He was just obnoxious, and we got asked to leave. And his name was Marlon, and, you know, I told Marlon, I said, you know, Marlon, I go to the meetings because I want to stay sober, and I want to change my life. And he said, I do too. And I said, well, I can tell you, you do, because we just got thrown out of there. And he said, well, I really do. And I gave him a ride home, and he said he really did. And I said, well, if you really do, I'll pick you up tomorrow at 7 p.m. And he said he really did. And that next day, I picked that guy up at 7 p.m. He was on his front porch, and he was sober. He got my truck, and he said, can we do one thing? And I said, what's that? And he said, no, I'll go to that meeting we were at last night. And you know, I took that guy to a meeting. But after I'd moved back to Idaho, and I went back up there, I happened to be up there. I was privileged to give Marlon his 8-year chip. That man never had another drink from that night on. And he used to always say that if I wouldn't have come along, he'd have never got sober. And I don't believe that. I believe that Marlon's time was Marlon's time. And when it's our time, the teacher appears. I believe that. I really believe that. And you know, I believe when it's our time, or it's time for us to hear something, it's there. I know that to be so. And you know, Marlon's still sober today up there. That I just happened to be the person that was there that night. And you know, that's kind of a magic story in Alcoholics Anonymous, that Marlon was where he was at that time, and I was where I was at. And I like to think of those as those little, the God deals in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, what he's done for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, it's kind of like Joe, when Joe come up there, and when I was in that, I was in a plane crash a few years back, and Joe was the first one there before my family or anybody. Keith had sent him over there for support. And when my mother and father still asked, you see, they ask about Mormon Joe quite a bit. You see Mormon Joe, and he's my family has a lot of respect for Joe just in that short time. And when they got there, my family went in, and Joe was there, and he kind of figured it was my mother and father, but he said, hi, I'm Uncle Joe. Because it was visitors only. And you know, the sponsorship walked Lisa through that, and you know, it kind of helped them do you know, help us get through that. And we had meetings in there. There were people bringing some meetings. Joe had gone down into the, from sponsor direction into the meetings down there in Spokane, and let people know we were there. And these people would come up, and they'd have a meeting in my room, and then they'd go over to Tate's room and have a meeting. And you know, it was a few weeks before I was able to see Tate. We were both banged up pretty good. And about the time I healed up from that plane crash, I started having some ailments, and I didn't know what was wrong. I was in from one doctor to another doctor to another doctor. I know I was in down here in Needles when we were over in Needles just before the Las Vegas men's retreat 2 years ago, and there was one morning I couldn't get up. I just couldn't. My back was in such pain, and so I was just taking huge amounts of ibuprofen and I'd end up with infections, all kind of infections. I kept ending up with these eye infections, and you know, I ended up with pneumonia in the hospital, with pneumonia. And then I had a doctor tell me that my problem was I had a crushed vertebrae in my back, and I had pleurisy pushing on this crushed vertebrae, and that's why it hurt so bad. And it just kept getting worse and worse, and I started ending up in the emergency rooms with muscle spasms so intense around my chest that I couldn't breathe. And you know, I didn't know what was wrong, and you know, the crushed vertebrae was about all I could think about, and I kept wondering, how could they miss a crushed vertebrae in a plane crash when they did MRIs of my entire body? And then I think, well, maybe they did, but it kept getting worse, and I kept getting this big lump on there, and they told me that was scar tissue. And I finally went to a chiropractor, and he told me there was something else up, and they sent me to get some tests, and I was diagnosed with cancer. And this was, believe it or not, it was 6-6 of 06 that I was diagnosed with cancer. And I remember the day I went in there, and the doctor, he told me, you know, the kind of cancer you have, it's treatable, but it's terminal. It's a terminal cancer. And that was a tough pill to swallow. I start calling Keith on a real regular basis through there. There was some fear and there was a lot of unknowns. The thing I found is I kept doing Alcoholics Anonymous. I start searching for people to work with and I start getting in worse physical shape, and then they start doing radiation and chemotherapy on me and it literally knocked me down. And I had these guys that I'd helped up there, the guys that I'd been sponsoring, the guys that I'd been hauled to meetings, they literally become my lifeline up there. All of a sudden they're in there and they're feeding me and they're bringing meetings into me and they're going grocery shopping for me. Keith told me one day, he says, because Alan died of cancer too, and there was some turmoil between Alcoholics Anonymous and the family in Alan's death, and he told me, don't let any turmoil happen between Alcoholics Anonymous and your family. And my family, I have two sisters that are also in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have five sisters, and two that are in Alcoholics Anonymous, two that really need to be here, and I have one sister that's normal. I'm the only boy. And when I say normal, she don't drink, so I don't know if she'd be here. So my parents are exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. They've been around it for ever since I was a kid, really. And I was never sent to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taken to my first meeting is how I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the little town I was at, they didn't have any, and I don't think they knew much about it, but they loaded me up, me and some other guy, and took us, and that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. But my family's been exposed to it my entire sobriety, and my mother and father have sat in a lot of meetings. They have a lot of respect for this. I remember hearing my mom, and I believe it was at my one sister, when my one sister had an AA anniversary, but my mother was in there, and she says, I don't know how Alcoholics Anonymous works. I just know it does from what I see happening in my children's life. So there's no tension. There's no problem between Alcoholics Anonymous and my family. But it's a lot easier to be taken care of by the AA members. I got one AA member, him and his wife, they're realtors up there, and Ron, Ron was at the Sky Dogs convention up there. He was also over at Sturgis with a couple of us. But Ron and he was over there. And Ron told me one day, he says, Mike, if it comes time to it that you need somewhere to go there at the end, he says, you have my house. And Ron, he told me one thing. He says, you won't have to go alone. I know I have that with Ron and Vicky. They're both realtors, and so one can pick up the other one's end. And I have that at the end. And that is, that's such a blessing to me, such a blessing to know that I have that, that I'm not going to have to go alone in this deal. I have two diseases. I have cancer, and I have cancer. And I'm here to tell you the treatment for cancer sucks. It really does. It's a painful treatment. But I'm telling you, if I had to have a choice to die between alcoholism and cancer, it wouldn't be alcoholism. It would be cancer. I would choose to die from cancer. And the treatment for cancer, for alcoholism, is fun. I mean, it can be fun. Last night there was a bunch of us, and we loaded up and we went over there to Cooper Street. And when we were at Cooper Street, we laughed on the way to Cooper Fellowship, and we laughed on the way to another meeting after that. But there was a lot of laughter in Dan's truck last night. There was a lot of laughter. And I believe that's a healing part of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that laughter. And I come in here, there wasn't any laughter when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. My life was just so... destroyed and with absolutely no idea of which way to turn. There was no laughter. And then that part in the big book where it talks about Bill and Bob, where they go to see AA number 3 and they're happy and they're smiling, and AA number 3 doesn't think it's very pleasant. He don't see very much humor in it, and I understand that, because when I come in here, there wasn't a lot of humor in it, and there is today. I mean, there's humor today. You know, yesterday when I first got here, and Keith got here, and John, I've been able to hang around John. He's fairly new, and I love hanging out with the new guys, and I was sent by John, and Keith looked at John, and he says, you know, John, Mike could be laying on a couch loaded up on Oxycontin, but instead he chooses to be here. And he said, look in Mike's eyes, John. And John was looking in my eyes, and he said, you know, Mike could be loaded. And John, all of a sudden, John said, are you on anything? I said, yeah, they got me on testosterone. And John said, he's looking in right in my eyes, and he said, what does that do? And I said, well, it makes you horny. And John couldn't keep eye contact from then on. And, you know, but I do. I can. I have a lot of humor in this, and you know, I believe the reason I get so sentimental a lot of times when I talk in Alcoholics Anonymous is from a gratitude level of what this thing's done in my life. You know what? 10 years sobriety, my mother gave me my chip, and you know, my mother has called me every one of my AA birthdays. She's never missed one from my first birthday, and on my 10th year AA birthday, she, and I didn't know this till I was 10 years sober. My mother gave me that chip, and she said, Mike, do you know why I've always remembered your birthday? And I thought it was, well, it's just such a special day. Your son got sober. And she said, Mike, that's the day my father took his life. And she said, I used to dread that day. Her father was a bad alcoholic, and he killed himself in a horrific way. He stabbed himself up through the gut into the heart with a butcher knife. And he did that when she was young, and my mother was haunted by that for years and years and years. And she said, Mike, I used to dread November the 11th. I used to dread that day. And she said, you're getting sober on that day is the greatest gift you could have given me. She said, because come November the 11th every year, I can think of a life given to me instead of the life that was taken from me by alcoholism. Another one of them little God deals, just as small as my AA birthday. You know, another one of those God deals. I went through a stem cell transplant. They tried a stem cell transplant onto me, and what they try to do with it is they try to get it to give you 3 to 5 years to put it in remission. And what mine did was they just stabilized the cancer, and I still have the cancer. And so it becomes an unknown again. You know, I could make it 3 years. I could be dead in 3 months, and it's an unknown. But you know what I've chosen to do with this is continue doing what I'm doing. And that day that I called Keith and I told Keith that I was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and Keith says, you know, a lot of people they take their lives or they end up drunk from that. And you know, I. The gift of Alcoholics Anonymous from the time they told me that is I had the choice. It was my choice, and you know, I chose not to drink. I chose not to to take my life, I read a saying one time about living. Living is consciousness, and I've always held on to that. Living is consciousness, and it struck me because of the way I used to drink and the way I used to use that I went for unconsciousness. I went for death. And there at the end, I wanted to die. And with my drinking, I just wanted to die. And I didn't end up dead. And today I like being conscious. I want to be alive. I like being conscious. I should have been killed 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago in that plane crash. And God gave me 3.5 more years. Looking back I wasn't ready for that 3.5 years ago for what I was told. 6-6 of 06. I wasn't ready for that, and today I am. You know, so Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, in the 18 plus years that I've been sober, the one thing Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is prepared me for that, where I'm okay with it. I lay my head down at night, and I'm comfortable. I'm just okay with who I am, and my little boy lives with me, and we have a fantastic relationship, me and my boy. a fantastic relationship, and that little boy is my best friend. He really is. We have a fantastic relationship, and I have a fantastic relationship with my father. He lives about 3 miles from my house, those are all gifts in my life. I remember one time my dad looking at me when I was back when I was drinking. He said, "You know, I watched alcohol destroy my father's life, Mike, and now I'm watching it do it to my own sons." And he said, "That's real hard." And you know, my dad doesn't have to watch me destroy my life by drinking. He gets to you know, they know I'm sober, and they don't question that. Even through all I've been through, they don't question that. They know I'm sober, and they know how important Alcoholics Anonymous is to me. They know I'm down here, and you know, they tell me to have fun and enjoy myself when I come down here. And you know, there at the end, I didn't have a relationship with my family. They didn't know if I was alive or dead. There hadn't been any contact with them. And you know, I built a relationship with my siblings, too. And, you know, my one sister I have in Austin, I talked to her the other day, and I was mentioning that, or she mentioned that Keith and Sue were coming out there. She'd seen it on a flyer, and I told her that they'll be there Friday night, and Keith said to get him a call, and I gave Keith my sister's phone number, and she said, "Well, what should I do?" And I said, "Well, just call him and tell him who you are." And she said, "And then what do I do?" And I said, "Well, then just be yourself, and he'll feel sorry for you." And she started laughing, and she said, "You know, that's not very funny." And I said, "Well, it got you laughing, didn't it?" I've been able to rebuild that friendship and that with my siblings. And you know, I have a nephew that's handicapped. He has a muscle disorder. He's been in a wheelchair since he was about 8 years old, and it's got worse and worse and worse. He's 24 now. They never thought he'd make it till 20. He's in bad shape. His internal organs as well as his muscle. He has a muscle disorder, which so his heart's weak, his lungs are weak, but Nick is popular. He's either 24 or 25, but he still has guys he graduated from high school with come and pick him up, hang out with him and stuff. And when he was going through high school, and they had the king prom the prom and the queen at the prom dance and stuff, and Nick was runner up. When he was running, there were two others, and I said, "Who are you running against?" He said, and this was several years ago, he said, "So-and-so basketball, or coach of the basketball team, and so-and-so, they're the coach of the football team," and then Nick in the wheelchair. But his attitude is just so positive. It's just so positive that Nick's popular. I was flipping through a channel one day, and they were showing a revival on TV. And I said, "You know, Nick, that's what we could do. I could take you to that revival." And Nick said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, they're healing people here." And he said, "It wouldn't work on me." And I said, "Why not?" And Nick says, "Well, Mike, this is how I'm supposed to be. This is just how I'm supposed to be." And he has total acceptance. And you know, I believe this is how I'm supposed to be. I don't, so I don't go into the self-pity, like, why me, you know? When I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, there at the end, there was a lot of self-pity. There was a lot of self-pity, you know, because why do I have to have alcoholism? Why can't I have been blind or with no legs or something? Why alcoholism? There was such a feeling of self-pity and anything but alcoholism. And I try to keep my head up, you know, with what I'm going through and have dignity, you know, have dignity. A lot of people ask me how I do it, and you know, it's the gift of the program. I do it one day at a time. I do this deal one day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and today I'm doing okay. You know, today I'm doing okay with where I'm at and physically how I feel, and that's all I have. I'm doing okay today. And, you know, Nick was getting ready to go out one night, and my mother, his grandma, was there, and she said, "Nick, I want you to be careful tonight." And Nick said, "You know, I don't know why everybody is worried about me all the time like that." And you know, a lot of handicapped kids follow sports really close, and Nick's like that. He follows basketball and football, and And it's a big part of his pastime, following sports. And he says, you know, Grandma, he said, I want you to know one thing. And like I said, he's in a wheelchair, and it's an electric wheelchair, and he's got to move it around. And he can't do anything with his hands. He does it with his, kind of puts the joysticker in his wrist and stuff. And he has absolutely no mobility in his legs. And he said, you know, Grandma, if anything ever happens to me, I want you to know one thing. I want you to know that I'm playing basketball. And I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot like that. That I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and what I was given the ability to do was get up and be a starter on the basketball team. I don't want to sit on the bench. I don't want to sit on the bench. And Grandma, if anything ever happens to me, I'm going to be playing basketball. And what a gift we have. And so if you're new or relatively new, I'm here to tell you, you can either sit on the bench in Alcoholics Anonymous, or you can get up and be on the starting front. And that's what I've chosen to do, is I've chosen to get up here and be on the starting front in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's been a fantastic voyage, a fantastic flight, you know, from where I come from the state I come from. A couple weeks before I got sober, I did one of the most sincere prayers I've ever done. And it was a mercy prayer to die. And I was pleading with God, please let me go. Please don't make me go on. It was a mercy cry. And God wouldn't grant that. Instead, God let me get sober. It's like that night I chased that cop, and I couldn't catch him. I believe God knew it was my time to get sober. When it's your time to get sober and you're ready to get sober, the avenues are open, the teachers are there, the doors are open, and all I got to do is keep following them. As much as I didn't know, I didn't know what to do to change my life, and I would just follow that direction. This is what I want you to do. And I would follow that direction, and it changed my life. It changed my life from being a drunk kid to where I eventually ended up. And I ended up living like a damn rat. I mean, living in the car with chickens and sleeping under the bridges and meeting the Salvation Armies and checking in one detox after another detox and sitting in the missions and telling myself one more time when I was drunk in the mission and they say, does anybody want to be saved? Don't raise your damn hand again. Because I'd be drunk in the missions, always raising my hand and they'd pray over me and turn me loose and I'd be drunk again. From that hideous state where I couldn't make any changes or get sober, to have being diagnosed with terminal cancer and having the choice of rather to drink or not, and choosing not to, and what a gift, and to have those guys in my life, to have those guys over there helping me. Doug was sentenced to 100 days of community service. And when he was sentenced to that, I told Doug, I said, you know, Doug, go talk to your probation officer and ask if you can work them hours off for me. And Doug says, my probation officer isn't going to let me do that. And I said, Doug, just ask him. And Doug went and asked his probation officer, and Doug explained the situation. And Doug come over to my house, he said, you'll never guess what my probation officer said. After that stem cell, when I needed somebody to go shopping and cooking and all that, Doug was able to do that for his community service. I want to tell you a story, one more story to finish up about Doug. But Doug come in, we brought him down, he was brand new, and down to the men's camp out there out in the desert over by Indio and 29 Palms, somewhere out by there. And Doug, on the way down, Doug was in real trouble when he got arrested there. But on the way down, Doug kept counting. And he'd count and he'd say, I'm only 28, I'm not 29. And then he'd count again and he'd have his driver's license out and he'd say, I'm only 28, I'm not 29. And I said, well, you missed a year. And he said, last year I was 28 when I should have only been 27. He said, I don't know where I got messed up, but it's been a couple of years ago. And Doug had been living in a garage for 2 years when he came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And what he got arrested for, that charge that Doug was arrested for carried 315 to life. And he was in a lot of trouble. And, And he just started going with us. Doug just started going to AA meetings with us and these campouts, and he started doing AA with us. And when we went to court, well, he threw his plea bargains and everything. They got it down to 3 7-15s. And when we went to court, Doug's judge says, "You know, young man, I'm here to tell you today, if you weren't doing what you would have been doing to change your life, because I can see that something's working in your life, you'd have gone to prison today for a long time." And Doug was given 6 months, six-month rider, and which kind of went against what everybody expected, and because Doug was facing a lot of time. And then the judge stopped, and the judge says, "You know, off the record," she said, "I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for what they've done in this young man's life." And she said, "My hat's off to you, because you have made a tremendous change in this young man's life. And I know if he continues hanging around with you, he will continue to grow and be prosperous in our society." And, you know, I believe that. And you know, that's just one more miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, God's given me the privilege to see enough of those things to know that he's behind the doors, or he's in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the hand of AA lays in God's hand. I know that today, and you know, that's a blessing. But it's an honor to speak here tonight to you, and it's humbling, which is good for me, but it's a joy to do it. Thank you.